I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
She broke records at shot put, served on the Rose Festival court, and had, by all accounts, the best laugh. At just 21, Yolanda Panek inspired dozens of middle school girls in her after-school science and math programs. She took her role seriously because she believed in lifting others up. But behind the scenes, Yolanda was caught in a cycle of intimate partner violence inflicted by the father of her son, the depths of which she kept hidden from many. Then, one day, she disappeared. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Milcania Diaz Rojas.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
I have a small warning for you for this episode. This episode does include a small child, but before we begin, the small child is okay.
Okay.
Because I just...
I was like, where are you going with this? What are you getting to here?
I'm anticipating your needs, Vanessa.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes. So I just don't want you to feel...
So the little one remains unharmed.
Yes. I mean...
I mean, physically unharmed.
Physically, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it bad that that's like our standard now?
Oh, that it...
Like, it's okay if they're just like a little rattled or if they need a lifetime of therapy. As long as they're not physically harmed.
Yeah, so this...
We're setting the bar really low for ourselves at this point of, like, what we think is okay.
Well, okay, so I would say...
Or a relief.
I would say it is relieving to know that the child survives this.
Yes.
Because so much of what we talk about involves people who do not survive whatever their encounters are, right? And so I think, like, yeah, that does change some things, talking about these issues all the time, particularly...
But it's just like a whole thing of like humanity, right? Like if you make it out of it alive, it's better than the alternatives. But a lot of the alternatives are also not so.
Right. So this does include really heartbreaking circumstances, mm-hmm. particularly for this child. And I cannot imagine their experience or, you know, the other people's experience in this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be trying to be as delicate as mm-hmm. possible when talking about these issues.
Right.
But yeah, I just knew that like as soon as I mentioned a child that like.
Right. The anxiety starts. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we're just going to begin. In the early morning hours of Friday, July 14th, 1995, a call comes in to 911. A man tells a dispatcher that a small boy has been abandoned inside a vehicle not far from Portland, Oregon's train and Greyhound stations. When police arrive, they find the boy asleep, still strapped into his car seat. Miles away at a discount motel called the Capri, the front desk assistant places a 7 a.m. wake-up call for Yolanda Panek, a young woman who had checked in the night before. No one answers. Later, one of the cleaners knocks on the door. Getting no reply, she keys into the room, ready to clean it for the next guest. The room is empty, but the bedding is missing and the mattress is soaked with blood. It doesn't take investigators long to link the two scenes. The young boy asleep in the car is Yolanda's 2-year-old son, whose name we won't be using during this episode, and the blood in the hotel room is hers. Today's episode features the story of Yolanda Panek. Like many of our recent episodes, there's little mystery surrounding what happened to Yolanda. As such, I just really want to warn our listeners that we will be talking about intimate partner violence today. I also want to make another thing clear before we dig in. Like every perpetrator I can think of, the man who killed Yolanda offers his own justification for her murder. And like I say every time, he, like every perpetrator, is a surviving member of this encounter, which allows him to shape and justify what happened. His happens to come in the form of religion. But make no mistake as we begin, it's just an excuse like it always is and not a commentary on that religion.
Right. I think it's important to clarify that too.
Right.
Yeah. There's a big distinction there, right?
Yeah. So we encounter this all the time, the justifications. And so his comes from a religious root, but that does not actually equate meaning to his actual religion, right? Mm-hmm. But let's go back in time before Yolanda met this man. She was born on June 24th, 1974 in Portland, Oregon. I don't believe her parents were married, and her mom was Sharon Pinnock and her dad was Cleveland Brigham Jr. He was a character, I guess you could say.
Wait, your face right now. What kind of character?
I mean, okay, I don't want to get too far down a rabbit hole on this, but of course I ended up there myself while researching. But in the late 1990s, state regulators basically called him one of Oregon's most enduring con artists.
Her dad?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I want to emphasize this has nothing to do with Yolanda, but there were several news articles about him. And if people want to do their own deep dive into his story, it is fascinating in its own right.
Can we just have like a little tidbit on like what kind of con?
Oh, so like it's like real estate and business transactions kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay.
So kind of like big scale stuff where basically he tried to get people to invest in various companies and didn't deliver on those promises.
Okay.
Or at least that's what he's accused of. But Yolanda, right. So she is the bright light. By the time she's a high school student at Madison High School, she was a track, basketball, and volleyball star. She won countless awards and records, particularly in shot put. And she was even on the 1992 Rose Festival court. This is not surprising at all. She was smart, she was athletic, and her friends said she always had a big smile and a loud and boisterous laugh. While she was in high school, she was dating a man 6 years older than her. We're going to call him A.
So I feel like so many stories like this start out like this, with like a young woman still in high school, a girl, like, you know, still in high school with this older man. But I mean, to be clear, this can happen with the same ages too.
Yes.
Like, but it just seems like a lot of the stories we've been picking lately have an age difference, but I think that can have a factor in it, but I think just the person's personality is the biggest factor in if they're going to be a violent partner.
Right. So intimate partner violence can happen definitely in any age type situation.
Right.
I think one of the reasons that we see kind of the replication of stories like this in these is, one, we've been covering a lot of stories in the 90s. And let's face it, a lot of what I experienced in the 90s and what you might have experienced in the 90s is like a lot of inappropriate age gap relationships. Right. I think.
Right. And it was always that way. Like nobody ever blinked an eye if it was an older guy with a younger girl.
Exactly. Also, what ends up happening is some like power dynamic issues are kind of already baked in to those relationships when someone's in high school, someone's outside of high school, right? And I think we have better language for it now than we did back then, but it's definitely predatory.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is already happening when she's in high school. So someone significantly older than her. Not long after she graduated high school, Yolanda and A married in a traditional Muslim ceremony, but this was a religious rather than a legal proceeding. So technically the two were not legally recognized as husband and wife.
Okay.
Religiously, yes. Later that year, in July 1993, Yolanda gave birth to their son. By August, 1 month later, she actually filed a restraining order against A, which she was granted. This was the first time there was clear documentation that Yolanda was experiencing domestic violence. In her filing, Yolanda said that A had shoved her and tried to strangle her. The attack was severe enough that she actually sought medical attention for her injuries. Whatever her history was with him before, her new concern was with her son. She said that A had told her that he had purchased 2 tickets to California, one for him, one for their son. And Yolanda was worried that he would take their son away from her.
Now, Yolanda also wrote this in her complaint. She said, "He has told me that as a Muslim, he has consulted with others who advised him to follow the law of the land. But if that were not the case, he would slit my throat and it would be justified."
Wow, he actually told her that?
Yeah. So to be clear, what she's saying is he had actually spoken to other Muslims and they said no.
No slitting your wife's throat.
Right. But he said, if not for that, that's what I would do. Now, 1 month later, though, Yolanda petitioned to have the restraining order removed.
Okay. Do you think that was like forced?
No, I think this is common in domestic violence and intimate partner violence, where you see there's a lot of complicating factors when someone's trying to negotiate that relationship. So like in this case, you know, she has a son with him.
Right? So is it, at this point, do you think she just is feeling like, oh, maybe part of this is me? Like a lot of people do that. And like, oh, you know, where am I at fault here? Maybe I should be working on the relationship. We have the son together.
Right. So there are.
It's confusing, I'm sure.
There are patterns of self-blame. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Which is why it's like, you know, it's kind of hollow advice just to tell people like, well, just leave when they're in a domestic violence situation. There's so many complicated factors from like economic, social, this parental, right?
I mean, and I think some people do feel like they're in love.
Yeah.
So there's possibly emotional ties as well.
Exactly. So there's all of these complicated factors. So just saying, oh, well, you should just leave. Mm-hmm. Now, their relationship, though, it continued to be tumultuous. And Yolanda and her son actually are living with her mother, Susan. And even when they're separated, tensions remained. Her friend Malik said that the two of them often argued about custody of their son. So it does sound like at some point they had separated. Mm-hmm. Outside of her relationship, Yolanda's life was flourishing. In 1994, she was hired by the YWCA to design and run a math and science program called Operation Smart for middle school age girls at their Northeast Center. There, every weekday, two dozen or so girls would gather with Yolanda, and she would lead them through activities like building volcanoes and studying bugs. Kathy Carnes, the interim executive director, said, "The kids are just crazy about her." It was a right fit for the girls, and it was a right fit for Yolanda. Her coworkers described her as caring, talented, and creative, all qualities that made her a great coworker and an even better role model for the group of girls that she was meeting with.
And that was so needed in the 90s, like a woman stepping in and being like, hey, girls, let's do some science and math together. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was something lacking, I think.
Yeah, it's more common today.
Yeah.
It's even still a struggle to like find good programming for like
to get the girls interested, like get any kids interested. But I don't know why those things don't seem to be geared towards getting girls interested.
Right. And then so like the 90s, it was like, so like having a program like this in the 90s and having Yolanda, who's just like everyone loved her.
Doing important work.
Yeah. Now, Yolanda was so dedicated to her job and to her students that when she didn't show up to work that Friday, everyone at the YWCA knew something was wrong. Karen, the director, said when she didn't come to work on Friday, that wasn't like her. If she wasn't going to come in, she was very dependable about calling in. And then she added again, it wasn't like her at all. Meanwhile, investigators arrived at the scene at the Capri Motel. There they found a blood-soaked mattress in a second-floor room that Yolanda had registered for the night before. The attendant at the desk said that Yolanda had come in alone to pay for the room, but that her car outside, there was a man and child waiting for her. As police surveyed the scene, more details became apparent. Though the mattress was covered in blood, the bedspread and blankets were indeed missing. And strangely, the cord to the bedside lamp had been cut. A more thorough examination of the scene revealed that there were bloodstains on the windowsill, and outside on the sidewalk, under the window, investigators found more bloodstains. Meanwhile, miles away, her son had been found alone in Yolanda's vehicle. While her son was secured and removed to family members, Yolanda's car also went through processing. Inside the trunk and elsewhere in the interior of the car, investigators found more bloodstains. It was clear from everyone gathered at both scenes that something horrible had happened to Yolanda. By the time the police were interviewed that Sunday, they primarily worked to make clear that their initial investigation had
not made clear a motive for her disappearance, for which at this point they had no suspects. Portland Police Detective Derek Anderson said, "There is nothing that I've heard from any of her friends to indicate that she was a substance abuser or engaged in risky behavior. In fact, quite the opposite." I just want to really emphasize what that man said.
Right. Right. How old is Yolanda at this point, I guess?
She's 21.
She's really young, too.
Yeah. So what did remain a mystery is why Yolanda would be at the Capri, which is a low, low budget motel where it's just like $31 a night, when her mom lived only a few miles away. And they had yet to identify the man who was with her on the night that she checked in. Meanwhile, those family and friends were holding out hope that they would get answers about what happened to her and where she might be. But they were cautious in their hope. Her friend Jenna said, "It's like a huge mystery with all these loose ends. I'd like to get them all tied up and have Yolanda alive at the end, but you just don't know."
We'll be back in a moment.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
On July 18th, the police named A as a person of interest in her disappearance. They emphasized, though, that he wasn't the only person that they were looking more closely at, that there were other people that they were going to be questioning again as well. A was, at the time, hundreds of miles away in East Palo Alto, California. A had graduated from Portland State University that June, so just 1 month before Yolanda went missing. He had quit his job in the composition room at the newspaper The Oregonian and had traveled to East Palo Alto to look for work in California. There he lived with his mom and his sister and someone who was described as his wife, though I'm not sure the legality of their relationship.
It wasn't Yolanda, though.
No.
Okay.
Because of the distance, police conducted their interview with him via phone. Days later, on July 20th, A was arrested at his mother's house and charged with Yolanda's murder. They then executed a search warrant on his mother's home. With the announcement of this news the following day, Lieutenant C.W. Jensen, a spokesman for the Portland Police Bureau, said, "At this point, we just don't know where she is." He then went on to say, "Here we had a man who had a motive, past violence with Miss Pinnock, and a restraining order, and proximity. What detectives found based on their investigations is he was here in town and he did murder Miss Pinnock."
How did they know that at that point?
So they hadn't revealed yet what evidence they had uncovered. So everyone was just kind of waiting around to see like how they had pieced this together, right? Because like to everyone's knowledge in Portland, he was, you know, miles and miles away, right? But the newspaper did interview A's grandmother, Catherine. She's the woman who had actually raised him as a teenager, and she knew in her heart, I think, that he was responsible for Yolanda's death. She said that A had been visiting Portland, so she's confirming that that's where he had gone.
Mm-hmm.
And he had returned to East Palo Alto, California, on July 14th, the day Yolanda's son and the bloodstained mattress were found. Catherine said that on Sunday, he went to her house in East Palo Alto. She said he was anxious, but I didn't know the reason. We knew she was missing, and when I asked him about it, he didn't say anything. He didn't seem to know much. It's shocking to me. I just can't believe it. You just never want to believe someone in your family would do something like this. The news of the arrest and the acknowledgement that Yolanda was dead was heartbreaking for her family and friends, but it also came after days of not knowing anything at all. Her coworker Gail said, "I was so afraid that if someone wasn't caught soon, that it would just fade away. Now we just need to find her to put closure on this. By August 21st, he was brought to Portland and arraigned into an Oregon court. During this arraignment, people heard for the first time some of the evidence against him. One of those pieces of evidence was a receipt for his purchase of a buck hunting knife, which was purchased on July 12th, just a few days before she was last seen alive. At his mother's home, they also found a letter to another woman describing his thoughts on killing the mother of his child. Now, originally hoping for a quick start to the trial, A was scheduled to a tentative trial date of September 18th, which was just a few weeks away. Understandably, this was delayed until March. Now, just before the trial was set to begin, A tried to fire his attorney, Edward Jones, and made noises about wanting to represent himself. He claims that Jones had not interviewed certain witnesses and had canceled appointments with him. The judge denied this request, stating that unless he could prove that Jones was actually incompetent as counsel, he couldn't do that because it would be at the public's expense because this was a public defender. He also cautioned A against representing himself, stating, "It'd be like me getting in a ring against Mike Tyson. I'm satisfied it would be a disaster if you attempted to represent yourself." On March 20th, the trial began. The prosecution was represented by Deputy District Attorney Rodney Underhill. Each lawyer made their own opening statements. The defense attorney, Jones, opened with a shocking statement claiming that Yolanda was involved in sex work and that he would be bringing forward a witness during the trial, a sex worker who had claimed to see Yolanda working on 82nd Avenue in Portland years earlier. With this move, it was clear that the defense was going to try to build a case that Yolanda had been killed by someone else, perhaps a client that night, and that's why she was at the Capri.
Did this come out of anywhere? Like, was there any evidence to back up this kind of thing?
So this is Matt with gasps in the courtroom. Like, her family is unprepared that this was going to be a line for the defense to go after. Like, this had not been on their radar at all.
Right. Because, I mean, we just had somebody saying, like, not long before this, like, you know, oh, no, she's always been like above and beyond on everything. Like, she's never gotten mixed up in trouble, you know.
Right.
And then this is kind of a big thing to say.
This is a huge thing to say. And it's a huge thing to bring into court like
right.
this. Right.
Like out of nowhere.
Yeah. So this did not align in any way with the Yolanda they knew.
Right.
When the defense, though, Underhill opened, he made clear his tactic was different. He was going over in detail A's documented movements and the forensic evidence from the scene. His plan was to establish a motive that A, believing that Yolanda had an abortion for their second child, used this to justify his attack on her.
Did that happen?
I'm not clear. So it was just like was not presented in the information that I had that this was factual, but it was presented that he believed that happened.
Okay.
During the course of the trial, Underhill showed that A purchased the knife in California. He then rented a car, drove to Portland. Once there, he was the one who arranged for Yolanda to meet him at the Capri with their son. He also brought forward witnesses that placed A at the Capri Motel and showed that Yolanda was killed with the hunting knife. Testimony also included details from the scene indicating it was police who believed that Yolanda had been murdered in the room before her body was thrown from the second floor window onto the sidewalk below. A then placed her body in the trunk of her car. Later, he transferred her to his rental car and she was taken to an unknown location. One of the witnesses the prosecution called was a man named Harold Freytag, who was an employee at the Portland Greyhound station. He said that he had witnessed A at the station screaming into a payphone. A, it seems, said he wanted money wired to him so that he could leave the area quickly. Investigators also believe that he was the one who made the 911 call reporting the abandoned child, his own son, before driving back to East Palo Alto later that morning in the rental car. In a missing persons and murder case that involves a case without a body, it was all pretty damning evidence. But it was likely that everyone was dreading Edward Jones's line of questioning after painting Yolanda as a sex worker killed by a client. It was actually a tactic that Jones would have to abandon. His one witness he planned to call, the unnamed sex worker, did not come to court to provide her testimony. Without it, during the closing arguments, he relied on a new tactic, suggesting that A was under extreme emotional distress at the time of Yolanda's disappearance and murder, hoping that his client would instead be given a manslaughter conviction. After the 10-day trial, the jury deliberated for just 1 hour before returning a guilty verdict for murder.
The thing with this one that, not that any part in this should make me happy, but one of the things that kind of does is that, like, going back to when the police were talking to his grandmother, She wasn't trying to protect him. And in so many cases, we talk about, like, the family is covering up what these men do.
Yeah.
And it's just nice to know that, like, there are some people out there that, you know, I'm sure she still, in a way, you know, loves and cares for her grandson, but also is going to admit to what he has done.
Right.
Like she said, nobody wants to think that their loved one can do this, but she knew hers did.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, like, I think it's so important that she did that.
Acknowledging the possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it's the right thing to do for Yolanda and for the boy, exactly. For the baby. So. Yeah.
Now, after the trial, Yolanda's family made clear their dissatisfaction with Edward Jones for his trial tactic, claiming that he knowingly made false statements of fact when he alleged that Yolanda was involved in sex work. They said that until the trial, there had been no public mention that this was the case or that she had involved in any sort of other illegal activity. Now, Jones defended himself, saying that his job was to defend his client, true, and that he had a witness who claimed to have seen Yolanda. And then he said that the notion that a young woman as bright and promising as Miss Pinnegg could not ever become, even briefly, a prostitute is false. My obligations to my client require me to bring these matters to the attention of the jury. Which, to be clear, I don't think Yolanda was involved in sex work, but I do agree with what Jones is saying on that specific point. Like, many people of all talents and backgrounds and abilities are actually involved in sex work, right?
Right. So that's absolutely true. The thing here, though, that kind of gets me when you're talking about this is, I mean, we haven't talked about many cases where a wife murders a husband because that's just not what we do on the show. Mm-hmm. But now my question would be, like, how many women murder their husband and then after, like, well, he was a sex worker.
Well, so his,
like, you know what I mean? It's just, these are the things people don't say about men. Like,
right. Like how they're painted.
Right.
So in this case, I think he was trying to build this whole case based off of this one witness that to open the idea of reasonable doubt that Yolanda might have been murdered by a client.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it wasn't his client at all. It was a sex work client, right? Mm-hmm. But with that person not showing, like, that whole thing just fell apart. But, like, my further point for this is, like, Jones, he goes forward. He acknowledges that these statements could harm her family. But he said he couldn't let his feelings or wouldn't let his feelings for their situation get in the way of his defense. And while I'm glad that he actually recognized the harm, it doesn't erase the fact that these claims were never substantiated beyond a woman who refused to show up for the trial, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that this has now become part of Yolanda's story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to talk about the trial and to talk about what happened during the trial, you have to talk about these unfounded claims, right?
And with any unfounded claims, there are always people out there who still think that that's the truth.
Right. So it's just like this has forever linked this to Yolanda.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're having a conversation right now about it, right? Because I can't talk about what happened in the trial without...
Right. It's what he accused her of, even if it has nothing to do with her or her life.
Exactly. Now, during the sentencing, Yolanda's parents, they were given a chance to speak. Her father said, "I never thought that one day I would be facing the demon that would murder my daughter. You are going to have a dark and terrible future." And her mother said in part, "You've tried to justify the cold-blooded, cowardly murder of my daughter. You are a disgrace and a shame to your Muslim religion." Now, the judge sentenced him to life in prison and that he would not be eligible for parole for a minimum of 25 years. This minimum was actually significant in that it represented a change from previous legislation. Prior to 1994, Oregon did not have a minimum sentencing law, which meant that someone like A could be paroled a lot sooner. But in 1994, Measure 11 made clear that a minimum sentencing for a whole host of crimes was the law of the land in Oregon. Since then, Measure 11 has actually been challenged repeatedly, with those challenges pushing back on how broad it was in terms of the crimes that would be included. But more significantly, many of those challenges had to do with youthful offenders, those between the ages of 15 to 18 that were kind of included in this Measure 11. So prior to Measure 11, it's possible he would not have this minimum sentencing, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of arguments on both sides of this, but I believe Yolanda's case would have actually been one of the earliest that fit under these new Measure 11 provisions to give this minimum sentencing. Now, the trial and conviction of A is notable, though there's a growing number of cases that fall under corpus delicti, which is quite literally like without a body.
Mm.
It's not always a given that the case will move forward with a trial and conviction. Like, we have talked about the first known case of a conviction in the United States of a disappearance and likely murder without a confession in our episode on Evelyn Throsby. But we've also talked about cases where the suspect is walking free with prosecutors reluctant to move forward with charges because there has not been the discovery of their bodies. Thankfully, like, this was not the case here, and Rod Underhill moved forward with Yolanda's case. Because of this, Yolanda's mother, who had been granted custody of Yolanda's son, renamed him in honor of the lawyer. By the time Underhill ran for county DA himself, Yolanda's son was 18 and voted for him in his very first election. Yolanda's disappearance and murder deeply impacted her community. Eventually, the YWCA, where Yolanda worked, created the Yolanda Project, which placed advocates within regional housing authorities, Portland's Walk-In Center, and a community location to assist survivors directly. In a 2014 report called One is Too Many, commemorating the 20th anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act, the Office of the Vice President included a list of organizations that had been able to use federal funds to provide services to survivors. The Yolanda Project was on that list. In its first year of operation, it helped 240 survivors and their children find housing. The Yolanda Project reported that nearly half of those would likely be experiencing homelessness without the aid of the project. Since its inception, the Violence Against Women Act has been under fire. Today, it still stands, but funding cuts, as well as the revocation of grant funding, has placed a lot of those domestic violence outreach centers in jeopardy.
That's sad.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Now, after the trial, her father said that the family had come to the terms with the fact that Yolanda's body may never be found. He said, "We don't want to find the body. We've rested ourselves with that." At Yolanda's memorial service that happened not long after she went missing, her trophies and ribbons for many of the sports accomplishments were on display. Close to 300 friends and family filled the room. Her father, at that moment, chose not to speak. But her mother read a portion of the letter that she had written to Yolanda for her high school graduation. In it, she said, "You have turned into an exceptional young woman. You're the type of child whose future we need not worry about." Today, Yolanda's name is one of many inscribed on the Parents of Murdered Children Memorial Wall in Portland. It's the eighth known memorial wall of its kind in the country and the only one in the Pacific Northwest.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Preparations for the Future, read by Milcania Diaz Rojas. Milcania is a rising Dominican-Canadian actor and writer based in Toronto. She secured her debut role in the HBO feature film, Cher. Since then, she has starred in several notable film and television productions, including Home Killing Queen, The Bold Type, and Slip. As a 2023-2024 alumni of the prestigious CBC Actors Conservatory at the Canadian Film Centre, Milcania made her writing debut with the short film Zuri. Her performance in the film has garnered significant attention, winning several awards and nominations. Most recently, Milcania can be seen in her leading role in the post-apocalyptic thriller 40 Acres, which had its world premiere at the 2024 Toronto International Film Festival and is now streaming on Hulu. She has also taken on a leading role in the indie film Fat Lady Sriracha that has yet to be released. With her dedication to her craft, Milcania is establishing herself as a dynamic force in the entertainment industry.
Preparations for the future. Yolanda Panic, 21. Missing since July 13, 1995, from Portland, Oregon. What you love about mathematics is a neat precision. The exactness of numbers exists to suggest all the mysteries of the world can be solved with an equation. You build a volcano in a classroom without having been inside one, never stood on an island made from lava flow. This is the exactness with which I measure what days I've lived that you haven't. I've watched a planet disappear. Every song you taught, ordering each planet into a rhythm, no longer makes sense. Half a world away, a tortoise may outlive us all, heaving his aging body around a garden. Half a world away in Europe, seeds are stored in an underground vault as the world prepares for a way to survive us both. But maybe survival is a little girl you once taught, now a woman, who remembers you every time she sings a song about planets, built a volcano of her own.
For more information about our show, please visit shegoesbyjanepodcast.com.
Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.